I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, in this season when college students graduate and high school students choose the colleges they will attend in the fall, we're going to talk about student debt. We're going to discuss the ins and outs of financing and education. My guests are Joe Wood and Bill Wozniak, both of Invest Ed, and Peter Dunn, also known as Pete the Planner, one of the creators of Smart Money U. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimitswfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about a subject that is near and dear to the hearts of just about every parent of college-age students themselves, and relatively recent alumni, and that is student debt, what it costs to go to college, and how you should finance it. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Joe Wood and Bill Wozniak. They're both of Invest Ed. And Peter Dunn, who's also known as Pete the Planner, one of the creators of Smart Money U. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. So I want to get an idea first of the scope of this. I mean, you know, since we're talking primarily about Indiana, how much student debt is there? I mean, do we have a dollar figure for that, or a rough one, an estimate, Joe? Or Bill. Okay.
Right. So nationally, you're looking at between $1.3 trillion and $1.4 trillion, right?
Okay.
So, and Indiana, as far as debt and many other of the loan metrics, is very similar. It's not exceptional in either way. It's not one of the exceptionally worst states for student debt or the lowest. So it's billions and billions of dollars. It's a sizable amount here in Indiana, yes.
So, and how much of that, how much is that per person? I mean, what's the average student loan debt?
Right. So an average can be divided up many ways, but you're looking at $29,000 in one of the metrics. Again, many times you'll have students that get $5,000, $7,000, $8,000, which bring down that number, and you'll have students and families with $80,000, $90,000 or more. But $29,000 is sort of an accepted average number ballpark, depending on how you slice it.
And how long on average does it take for the student or the alum? Joe keeps throwing everything your way, Bill. Either one of you. But Bill, how long on average does it take for someone to pay that off?
Right. And again, it depends on the situation. You have students that go to community college and may take a couple thousand dollars, right? And so there are deferment periods, there are forbearance periods. It's how it gets dealt with. In some cases, you have students that take on $80,000, $90,000 for some of the top programs here in the state, but they get a very high income coming out of college. So you'll see student loan repayments that take 5 years or 10 years. You'll see some of the federal programs with a 10-year ballpark. But that could be deferred or forbearance used to stretch that out more towards 14, 15 years. And some of the refinance programs go more towards 20 years. So it's varied depending on the situation, the student, where they go to school, and their finances.
Pete the Planner, what criteria should students and parents use in determining how much money to borrow for a college education?
I mean, that moves all over the place. But my rule of thumb is sort of a 30,000-foot view to this thing. It's like spelunking. You can go in the cave, but you better have a plan to get out of the cave. And with student loans, so often parents and students feel like that acceptance to college is the finish line, or they feel like moving your tassel on your cap is the finish line. unfortunately, it's not. It's just the beginning. So I think, very simply put, the numbers don't even do it justice, because you've got this movement culturally where, hey, college is for everyone, and there's some people shouting in the other direction. But culturally, we've got this situation in which there's no way for some people to get out of some of this debt because they have no income, job, credit history, or anything else. And I think that's the challenge. And I know the fellows in InvestEd, they deal with that a lot, of this idea of trying to make sure that parents and students are making the right decisions before they even get to school.
Yeah, the question of how much is the right number, it's a complicated question. If you go to college for 1 year, don't finish, have $7,000 in debt, that's way too much. You can't get a job. You have a lot of those difficulties. If, on the other hand, you go to law school at a premier law school and you've got $100,000 in debt, clearly you're going to have the shovel to kind of work that out over time. And, you know, your circumstances for employment are good. And just every case is different.
Well, and that example you mentioned of law school, I mean, that's become kind of a challenging area, too, because a lot of people have been borrowing significant amounts of money to get through law schools now, and we found that because the business model for the legal profession is changing, that many of them, unless they – I noticed you qualified by saying a top-tier law school.
Right.
Unless they have gone through a top-tier law school, that they aren't likely to be able to get out from under their loans. So it's created in some ways the perfect storm for a lot of law schools, is they train people how to sue people, and then they turn around and get sued themselves by the students who really have no way to get out of this. So are there anyone here, I'll throw this out too, are there any sort of rules of thumb that you should use in terms of determining what the right amount is and how to structure it?
You know, I have heard people say something to the effect of, you want to have your total student loan balance be congruent with what your first year salary is upon graduation. Now, very frankly, that's a little too tidy for me. It's a little too cute. I don't know if it works, but in some applications, it can work. I think where things get complicated is, now, we're talking federal loans at that level. You can certainly fund an education with federal loans in the $30,000 range. It's when you start taking on private loans or Parent Plus loans where the loan balances could balloon well into six figures.
That's a good point, Pete. And Bill and his guys, 400 times a year around the state of Indiana, are teaching people to chase free money first, scholarships, grants. Indiana's a very, very generous state in terms of free money. Through our Commission for Higher Ed and the various grant programs, Pell Grants. You should exhaust all those things, and then to federal loans, exhaust all that before you even consider what Pete just mentioned, private loans or Parent Plus loans, that sort of thing.
Let me take a step back, because it sounds like what I'm hearing here is that there ought to be some evaluation of what your earning prospects are likely to be. That, for example, if you plan to go into a career where the salaries are going to top out in the high 30s, but it satisfies you, you probably shouldn't go six figures into debt to fund that education. Bill, you're nodding your head.
Right. We talk with students in high schools all over the state all the time about this. Let's say you're a student very energized to do social work or some of these types of things that are very rewarding, very good for society, but might not have the highest price tag that a doctor might make or what have you. And if the school is chosen, a very good school — we never use good school, bad school, we never speak like that — but a school where the family situation is going to require that the student borrow 20, 30, or 1,000 or more per year, they could get derailed very quickly as they graduate, they want to go do their social work or they want to go help some families, but now they have $100,000 in debt or something like that where the starting salary is just not going to line up with that. They're going to be left with default or very strong difficulty of pushing out the loan, increasing the loan repayment amount over time, or have to walk away from what they wanted to do, you know, for their career. And it's sad to see it. But the decisions have to be made when the student is 17, 18 years old before the whole process begins often.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the issue of student debt here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what our regular listener Jerry has done, and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, back in 1958, President Eisenhower signed the National Defense Education Act. Many of us who attended college in the 1960s, after elimination of its loyalty oath requirement, had such loans. Interest rates were, as my geezerly memory recalls, 1.5% or 2%. Repayment did not begin until 6 months after graduation, and repayment was completely deferred as long as the student was attending any postgraduate classes. If Americans were smart enough in the immediate post-McCarthy era to recognize that very expensive student loans are a good idea, why do we now not consider such liberal terms as serving an overwhelming public interest? I'll throw that one to Joe since he's taking a deep breath and sighing.
That's a great question, Jerry. You know, and I'm probably the only guy in the room old enough to remember the old federal defense or the national direct student loans from the late 1970s and early 1980s.
No, you're not.
those terms, those general terms, still exist today. Mm-hmm. The idea of taking a low interest loan, I think it all came about with the Higher Education Act of 1965. Where they introduced the what is now known as the Ford program, was the Guaranteed Student Loan Program, where in exchange for a low interest rate and reasonable terms, you can take an unemployed, uneducated 18-year-old and help them accomplish something that maybe their parents couldn't, which is to get a college education or to learn a trade or whatever else, which in the days of the Great Society created a better taxpayer, and mm-hmm. therefore, you know, that was the balance. And over the years, those programs have ebbed and flowed, you know, succeeded, failed. National Direct Student Loan Program caved in on itself back in the early 1980s because of the weight of defaults, not dissimilar to some of the things you're seeing today with certain slices of the current loan programs. But the idea is still a good one. You know, take a young person, give them reasonable terms, manageable terms, and then, you know, they may use those dollars to get their education. And, you know, that's why InvestEd was created back in 1980, to help people complete their education.
Yeah, as I recall, because I was a product of that era as well, the terms were low, but there were a lot of news stories about the collection rates, basically, and there weren't really penalties in place for defaulting, significant ones for defaulting on your student loans. Was there any thought at the time to just saying, okay, we're going to continue maintaining these low interest rates, but if you stop paying, we will come after you?
Well, I think that was one of the things that happened in the 1980s, probably the mid-1980s, right after tax reform in 86, and then a number of other things. Bankruptcies, you know, the defense, if you will, of bankruptcy in a student loan mm-hmm. situation was used, and that's why today it's eliminated. You can't bankrupt out a student loan.
That's one of the challenges of this is that once you take on a student loan, if you declare bankruptcy or you have other financial problems, that lies in the weeds and waits for you to come back. What is the reasoning for that? I mean, is there, Bill?
Well, and just a quick thought on what you were speaking about. And right now, the Stafford, the typical student loan, you can get a couple grand at 3%. The thing that happens that explodes all the numbers is that only gets how much of an education that costs $25,000, $30,000, and where does the rest of that money come from, right? It's only a portion of the whole, and how the rest of that bucket gets filled is where the big numbers sort of come in.
We are talking about student debt today on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Joe Wood and Bill Wozniak. They're both of InvestEd. And Peter Don, who's also known as Pete the Planner. He's one of the creators of Smart Money U. This is the program for you. If you have a college-age student, if you are, in fact, a college-age student or a recent alum, this is the program for you to take part. And I see we're getting a lot of phone calls and messages coming in. We're going to take some of those after we come back from the break. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about student debt today on No Limits. My guests are Joe Wood and Bill Wozniak. They're both of InvestEd. Peter Don, who's also known as Pete the Planner, he was one of the creators of Smart Money U. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Christina has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Christina, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I just wanted to comment, add to a comment I just heard, which is my son just completed sophomore year at a state school here, and he's in this boat where he's an average student. He didn't get, you know, excel in academics as far as a perfect 4.0. He didn't qualify for many of the academic scholarships. He got a FAFSA loan the first 2 years, but for this fall, he didn't qualify for that either. And it does only cover a portion of his education, which is now very expensive for him, and I'm very concerned when he graduates. What do I do?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Christina. Bill.
Right. Well, first of all, the typical student loan, the Stafford loan, the federal loan, the student would be eligible for that. They're eligible for, like I said, the few thousand dollars. So that would be part of it. But then in the rest of it, people look at the parent loan. If they can't find scholarships, if they can't find grants, if the institution is not going to give more money, then they look at the parent loan, right? And so the parent loan is something that some parents want to do, and some parents say that that's not going to be an avenue we are going to or able to travel. And then after the parent loan, the next step is the private loan market. And depending on people's FICOs and credit situations, sometimes they find a better rate and sometimes they do not. But that's sort of the hierarchy or the tier of where the money would come from.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Aaron. And if you would like to reach out, join the conversation by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Aaron writes, "Hi there, listening to the program right now. I had the good fortune to go to college for free because one half of it was paid for via academic scholarship and the other half was paid for by my parents. This was 1993, and college costs were less than one-sixth what they are today. I now have a five-year-old son. How much do I need to save monthly to ensure he can spend 4 or 5 years at a state school without taking out a loan? Let's assume he won't get any academic or athletic scholarships. I know what a leg up that absence of debt gave me in 1997, and it's critical to me that he begins his adult life with that same advantage." Peter Dunn, Pete the Planner, I think that's a question that's right in your wheelhouse.
It is, and in fact, my personal situation is not terribly different, other than I didn't get a scholarship. I think we need to make that very clear. I was neither intelligent nor talented enough to get a scholarship, so that needs to be noted. Okay. There's a couple things. Number one, here's what parents are currently doing. They are hoping, with their fingers crossed, that the entire system changes, thus alleviating the pressure of saving for college. I remember when my children were born doing the math. I went to Hanover College, so as a Franklin professor, that's probably not great. Went to Hanover College.
We'll overlook it for this purposes of this conversation.
I remember doing the math, and I remember thinking, man, something's going to have to change because this is tough. And very frankly, I think that's what parents are hoping, that, well, hopefully there'll be some online learning system that'll change. But very personally, I stay for my kids' education to save my retirement. And what I mean by that is I don't want Parent PLUS loans. I don't want my kids moving back in with me because they're saddled with student loans. And when you look at Vice President Mike Pence has between $95,000 to $280,000 in Parent PLUS loans. And former Governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, who was trying to be the presidential candidate on the Democratic side, he's got a stupendous amount of $340,000 in Parent PLUS loans. That's the concern, is that parents should save aggressively when their kids are young to save their own retirement and to prevent the boomerang kids from moving back in. So that is why not only do I try to save aggressively for retirement, but I don't take the approach of, well, my kids are on their own, they're going to have to figure it out the way I did, because the game has changed, and it's impossible to have that expectation.
Bill.
On our website, we have a toolbox, what we call it, the College Planning Toolbox. And what it does is it takes the average increase over time of the cost of particular colleges based on, you know, historical trends, and also what a family has saved or not saved. So it's a free toolbox. Families can go in, plug in the information, put in the age of the student. And again, this is based on projections, but it runs the numbers for us that I'm not able to do in my head to show exactly what the pace is projected for a family to save. It's helpful. There are some assumptions made, but it's a helpful gauge of what a family should save.
We have gotten a question via Facebook from our regular listener, Gary. If you want to join the conversation by finding us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Gary writes, could someone address the hypothetical student in the low income demographic with $138,500 in federal loans who did not get a job after an associate degree, no job after a bachelor, and graduating with a master's into no job? Additionally, have the low-income demographic been taken advantage of or, worse, misled by an education industry? I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts on that, because there is a debate about, you know, just how much education is necessary now. Bill, we'll start with you.
Two quick practical items. Income-based repayment, the federal loan portion, income-based repayment is the first thing that pops to my mind. I don't know the intimate details of the particular loans, but the income-based repayment program that the federal loan the Department of Ed has is something that has helped a lot of families, so that might be helpful in that regard.
Joe.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why, as Pete was mentioning, you know, you've got to think this thing through as you go through and not overload your debt. I mean, you know, and Bill and his guys talk about working part-time jobs, doing work study. There really are a ton of resources that people don't think of when they're heading off to college or while they're at college that could, you know, provide them with some additional resources to cut those, you know, cut into that, whatever your necessary gap-filling funding mechanism is, be it parents or whatever. In terms of, you know, I mean, I honestly don't delve into the politics of it. I do know, you know, just in my own case, I have grown children, and I've watched them, how education is delivered to them is changing. And you were talking earlier about, you know, kind of folks hoping for what I would call the lottery or the miracle solution down the road coming. I think Pete also made a good point about that, and Bill and his people talk about this. If Invested had the ability, we would be at every maternity ward in the state of Indiana, and we would be signing people up for 529 plans, because that is probably one of the strongest tools that we have in this state.
Pete.
Yeah, at the risk of not only saying something wildly unpopular and possibly disagreeing with what someone just said, I have 2 points. Number one, this idea that income-based repayment is a consolation to those that are struggling. It's a pretty terrible consolation, right? When someone's saddled with $130,000 in debt, even if you say to them, hey, you can pay $120 a month and you'll only be paying for the next 80 years, that's not really a solution, right? And so to answer the original question, yes, the education complex has failed that person. They have misrepresented the overarching value of an education. And the evidence of this is rampant. I mean, you can look at for-profit education and how during the recession students were recruited not to get an education per se, but as a way to fund their life with student loans when they had no job. And you can say, well, surely that's isolated to for-profit space, which is a really ugly space, and we all have fun stories there. But you'd be crazy not to think there was a little bit of carryover and misrepresentation within the not-for-profit public education space, misrepresenting what a college education can do for you. So, unfortunately, when we say things like, well, you know, good thing there's income-based repayment or student loan forgiveness, that's just kicking the can down the road and not really solving the systemic issues.
Bill.
Yes, and please don't interpret my comment of, hey, this is great and everything's fine and take out the loans. We just have families that walk up to us and say, I have $100,000 in debt. What do I do? And if I give a comment about we can redo the whole education system, which I think has a lot of merit, and you and I and Joe and everybody in the room, I think, is on board with that. The problem is when a family walks up and I say, over the next 10 years, we have a plan to change things, they look at me and say, but what about me? Like, what do I do today? And that's all I'm pointing out is maybe a possible avenue for this particular student.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we all agree on is with students, and I know Pete agrees with this because I can tell by what he just said, it is an awfully difficult thing to have a kid sitting in the registrar's office who has to have statistics 101 or they can't stay on track. And staying on track, by the way, is the best way to limit your student debt. They can't stay on track, so their only option is to quickly sign a piece of paper, a loan document, so that they can keep their process moving. So they're making a life-changing decision in a moment of maximum pressure. And the more the system, whatever you call the system, be it the school's part, the parents' part, our part, everyone, the more you can do to make that a less urgent decision for these people, where they can plan it out, think it through, and examine options, the better off everyone's going to be.
Let me toss this out, because a friend of mine who is a financial planner by profession argues out of experience with her clients that, in fact, where we ought to do kind of the testing is on the front end and say, in effect, and I want to hear the arguments about this, that, for example, if you plan to go into social work, which traditionally doesn't pay a whole lot, that you should qualify for maybe $5,000 worth of loans. On the other hand, if your ultimate goal, and it's a realistic prospect, is that you want to go into some very specialized form of surgery where your income is likely to be tremendous, you qualify for 20 or 25 times that much. Is that viable? What would be the problems with it, Bill? Right.
And we hear this, all the time. And from a practical, looking outside the system model, right, this makes great sense in a lot of ways. But from a, as I think Joe mentioned, or it was Pete mentioned, we don't handle the politics of this and we don't handle the whole structure. We help families that are coming forward that are about to embark on this process and try to give them advice and help with that. The point being is that school X that charges $43,000 and their cost of attendance is this, has the right to have this program, right, and offer it to students who are going to need $38,000 in loans, and the starting salary for that job is $30,000. So when we sit with a family and we look at their finances and we look at their situation, we can see with the award letter how much they're going to have to borrow, and we know the rough starting salary. But if the student and the family say, we're going to take this, and the schools have the right to offer it, knowing their cost of attendance, that's just a framework and a situation that exists. Somebody changing that nationally or statewide or what have you is outside the scope of what we're able to do.
We are talking about student debt here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Utsav has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Utsav, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Certainly. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yeah, not too bad, actually.
All right, good, good.
So I'm actually a physician. I work here in the Indianapolis area, and a lot of this discussion is centered on undergraduate debt, which is obviously a huge thing. I myself have carried significant amounts. I still carry. The other thing, other piece of this that I wanted to talk about was the graduate student debt. I feel like the graduate student interest rate is significantly higher than the undergraduate rate for an unknown reason to me. I feel like people who have graduate degrees are probably less at risk to default on the loan, given their specialized degrees. But that in and of itself, I feel like makes a decision when you choose a specialty, you know, people going into that specialized surgery or people going into primary care, the decisions that they make are being weighed by how much debt they're carrying. Even though, you know, it may be, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt and their salaries may be 200, but their salary could also be 600, for example. And so I feel like some of the things that we are trying to achieve in our society, you know, are negated by the debt that we're carrying.
Right.
Thanks very much for the call.
The grad plus ability to borrow. We talked about the Stafford loan and the typical federal student loan having a cap of $3,000 and low amounts. Once you start to get to that outer level, the caps come off. The amount to be able to be borrowed are significantly higher. And now you're dealing with a graduate student, right? So they're at a different part in the whole process. And they're very specialized, and this is where the numbers really grow quickly. On the other hand, that is sometimes the belief where, whether it's attorneys or doctors or what have you, that the salary is going to make up for that. But this is definitely the part of the whole process where the numbers get big very quickly.
We've gotten a comment via Twitter from a listener named Mel. And if you want to find us on Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. Mel writes, we have $200,000 in education debt. We drive old cars, don't go on vacation, are extremely frugal. Sorry, economy, can't contribute to your growth. The more money we make, the more we have to pay in loans with income-based repayment. Pete, how about if I throw that one your way?
Yeah, so you know, I love this idea of moral hazard, and I try to find applications for it as much as I can. And it's the idea that essentially there's no risk. There's no risk to this all. And I think sometimes when we take on college debt, whether it's undergrad or postgraduate degree, we really don't understand the risk, and we should. We think, well, it's just a payment. It's like making a cell phone payment. Well, this isn't a payment. You're acquiring a debt to acquire. You can't even really call it an asset. An education is an asset in some degree, but what you do with it matters. What sort of asset it is. So to
yeah, and you can't sell it to get out from under the debt. Yeah.
Right, and so I think that's where this gets really confusing. Is that on the base level, when someone takes on student loan debt, people are not even willing to say it's a debt. They're not willing to say, yeah, I need to get out of debt. What people really try to do is to afford the payments. And look, did I just answer Mel's question? Of course I didn't, because there was no answer. It's a challenge of people just misunderstanding money at the root. But look, systemically, so does the government, so do businesses, individuals, and college students aren't that far off as well.
And I'm seeing here we've got the phone banks lit up. We've got a lot of questions coming in about this. So I am going to ask both our listeners who are sending in questions or calling in to be brief in framing those questions. I'm going to ask the folks on our panel to try to be brief so we can get as many people in as possible. We are talking about student debt today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Joe Wood and Bill Wozniak. They're both of InvestEd. And Peter Dunn, who's also known as Pete the Planner. He's one of the creators of Smart Money U. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about student debt today on No Limits. My guests are Joe Wood and Bill Wozniak. They're both of InvestEd. And Peter Dunn, who's also known as Pete the Planner, is one of the creators of Smart Money U. And I said before we went to the break that we've got a lot of questions coming in, so everyone here, try to be concise. Got a question from a listener named Morton via email. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Morton writes, John, please ask Joe and Bill, apparently your old friends, to look at the other side of student debt. Who owns the loans? If the U.S. passed a law wiping out all student loan debt, who gets hurt by that? Such a move would boost consumer spending, but what would be the damage to the economy?
Morton, Joe. It is so good to hear from you. I haven't heard from you in a while. It's great to hear from you. You know, the taxpayers own that debt. The way that sits today, the United States taxpayers own probably, what is it, $1.2 trillion of the $1.3 trillion in debt. So to wipe that, is, if you think of it as a business, that's on the government's balance sheet. So if they wrote it all off, he's exactly right. It would, you know, consumer spending would increase and a lot of things would churn the economy, but the government would lose $1.2 trillion.
I always wonder, in the addition to that answer, I always wonder what happens to the people that missed the buyout by 2 years or 1 year or next year, like the people that just paid off $63,000 by scrimping and saving for 10 years, but that's for another day.
Yeah, exactly.
We are talking about student loans here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Paul has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
Just fine. What's on your mind?
I went through the process of getting loan income-driven debt repayment program. It took about 2 years. You know, the organization called me and said, hey, I qualify, you know, and they got $700 out of me. And I did that process. I had to sign a lot of papers electronically, and then they forwarded it all to the appropriate people at my my loan servicing company. Then they hung on to my paperwork for so long, and it was May the next year. I got a bill, and they said that they never contacted me. I never received any paperwork from the organization, and they told me that the paperwork had aged out of the system.
Right. The
thanks very much for the call, Paul.
The red flag that went up for me was the they called me and the pay part of it. And this is very common, and we're short on time, but just that's not a you're not supposed to pay for that. That's entities out there trying to charge for something that is a free service, and we'd be happy to help any families that need that. It's free, and it's directly through the government, and entities are charging to be a middleman for that to try to help with the paperwork. And
we have gotten an email question from more a comment from a listener named Libby. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Libby writes, we are at the end of paying for two kids' college education. We saved the money for their education in advance. We did this by prioritizing. Spring break, vacations, travel, sports, dining out, many other expenditures came after we made the deposit into the college savings account. Spring break in Mexico or travel soccer is not a necessity. It is something that is nice to do after you have made the college savings account deposit. Thank you, Libby.
Congratulations, yeah. Libby. You did it right.
Yep. Pete, how much of this can be dealt with just with adequate planning and prioritizing, as Libby seems to be asserting here?
To some degree, I mean, and I'm going to give you some rough numbers, but if let's say actually Joe in the studio ends up has a baby today. He and his family have a baby today, and they make equal deposits over the next 18 years, equaling $40,000. At an 8% rate of return, by the time that kid's ready to go to school at the end of that 18 years, there's actually $80,000 there. Only $40,000 of principal, $40,000 of growth. Whereas if you use student loans to fund that same amount, you're talking about $115,000. So it's not a difference between, well, $80,000 versus $115,000. It's $115,000 versus $40,000. My point being, if you leverage time, if you spend a little less money on your favorite sports team's bib for your baby and a little more on education, then it is doable because you're leveraging time. Unfortunately, and this is as anecdotal as it gets, I think most parents wake up to college costs when the kid's 12, and then time is out the door.
We had a family walk into one of our eighth grade presentations, beautiful, wonderful family, and they said, "Are we too early?" And I said, "Let's talk afterwards." And as we were walking out afterwards, they go, "We're late."
Oh, yeah.
We have gotten a question from a listener named Andrea via Facebook, and you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Andrea writes, "How is the debt of current college students compared to older generations? Is this become a bigger problem or has it grown smaller?" Joe?
You know, it depends on how you look at that. I mean, there are a variety of arguments about, you know, did debt cause the inflation in education, or did, you know, the inflation in education cause the inflation in debt? It's quite a bit higher. You know, I think when I went to college back in the 70s and 80s, I had $3,000 total. But, you know, it only cost me $700 a semester to go to college, which isn't the case now. So, you know, inflation happens. I'm sure, as Pete just detailed, you know, time matters. Time has a cost, and it also has a return. So, you know, kind of grew that way.
We have a chart that we show that shows versus the consumer price index, you know, and how education is shooting up higher, definitely compared to the previous times. At the same time, the discounting rate, which is where the net price of the college is critical, the discounting rate has gone up. So the question becomes, how much is the discount rate for your particular situation versus what you're going to pay? The sticker price, if you will, versus your net price is a key factor.
We've gotten a question via email from a listener named Andy. Email address, again, is nolimitswfyi.org. That's somewhat on point, says, to what we're talking about. It says, "Can you speak to the participation of the state and federal government funding public universities? I have heard part of the increase in cost is that universities do not receive the same percent of state and federal funds as in the past. Is this true?" Bill.
Right. So you have the universities receive from the state universities, obviously, some of the infrastructure money and how those things are divvied up and what percentage is going and all that. And then the sort of one-off help is with the grant programs and the 21st Century Scholar Program and these things. So you sort of have two buckets. You have the amount where the state gives the money to the schools. And right when the legislature meets, you have discussions about how much money is going to go, what's the appropriate amount. And I'm definitely not an expert in that or what the right number is. I don't know that. On the money that is given for the students that attend there, when you see the national rankings, Indiana always does well with the state grant programs for how much is given for the student to help pay their cost of the college. But I do understand the question. It's the other part of it, the infrastructure and those types of monies that are very important, and I'm not an expert on that.
Gotten a tweet from a listener named Gretchen. And again, you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. Gretchen writes, "Use student loans for undergrad and grad school. Now concerned, public service forgiveness program will end before I reach 10 years of service." Bill or Joe, either one?
Yeah, there has been a challenge to that in the last couple of months. I saw that from somewhere in the news. The new administration is looking at that. The statistics on loan forgiveness, I guess, have ballooned in the estimates, the budget estimates, and things of that nature. So I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. over time? That's an open policy question.
The letters that went out saying that your job or your particular situation is eligible for the loan forgiveness, and then sort of the different message now is the part that I haven't seen the letters in particular. I've read the news reports, but you can imagine somebody who thought for 6 or 7 years they're going to get loan forgiveness, and then they hear or they get a message that they might not. Obviously, a lot of panic, but it's an administration decision. And
well, is that something they can do retroactively, though? I mean, one would argue that if you're bound by the terms of the loan to pay it back, they're also bound by the terms of forgiveness.
As I read it, and again, Joe and I were looking at the same news reports, this whole concept or this whole discussion began about a year ago. So it was being looked at and what was going to be eligible and what was not going to be. When they received the letter or the information a year by year that, yes, you are in a qualified position, apparently there's an interpretation that wasn't a solid, yes, this no matter what is legal and binding. I think the courts are going to be busy with this one.
As is always the case, though, you should always be an activist, meaning an educated consumer is always, you know, the best customer. They need to know all the terms and conditions. They need to ask a lot of questions. They need to drill down to the real answers and not depend on news reports. Contact the servicers and contact the Department of Ed.
We're talking about student debt here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Kimberly has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kimberly, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is, I have a high school junior who's looking at her college options. We've done a good job with help from aunts and uncles and grandparents of putting together a college fund that would allow her to go to an in-state public school and basically graduate with no debt. But, of course, she's looking at some schools that are private and more expensive. And wondering, you know, is there ever a reason to do the loan? How do I guide her, you know, her heart versus her head? And, you know, I'm just looking for some advice there.
Well, I'm going to throw that one to Pete first and then let Bill chime in, too. Pete?
I mean, you go to the numbers. I mean, you run an illustration to show what the payment would be and what the impact on her lifestyle would be post-graduation if she made that decision. Would also impact her ability to buy a car, where she wants to live, what food she eats. And I think previously what most people do is just say, hey, it'll be bad. Trust us. It's going to be bad. Show her the numbers. I mean, and if she wants to make an adult decision at 18, then there's not a lot you can do with it. But I think part of the education process is looking at actual numbers.
Yes. Bill. Yes, I echo Pete's statement so we can get more calls in. Yes.
We've got an email from a listener named Bethany, or Beth. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Beth writes, thank you for your program today on school loans. I'm actually over a decade out of my undergrad, and after college I got married and consolidated my school loans with my husband's. Unfortunately, we got divorced, and this loan is the last of my debt. I'm looking for any advice on the best path to try to split this. The court each gave us our fair portion or column to pay each month, but after doing this for years, we're making no progress. Even after paying on this loan for over 10 years, it is even larger than it was when I left college. Is there any possible path to splitting this loan so I could make a dent and pay off my own portion? Calling the loan holder has seemed to yield no results. Thank you for any help you could offer. This problem has seemed quite hopeless to me. Pete, I'll throw that one to you first.
Yeah, I mean, that's when you get into some alternative products in refinancing loans. And very frankly, the guys in the studio are much more well-versed at that.
Yeah, is there a way actually to have somebody else purchase your portion of the debt?
There's two parts to the question. The part about the separation, I don't believe that can be done. I'm not an attorney, but the separation of the part, as Pete mentioned, though, the refi part, there's potential, depending on the FICO scores and the situation, that the rate could be lowered, which would help the repayment. But we would need to know the particulars. Yeah.
Is there a way, if Beth wants to contact you guys, to get maybe some more detailed analysis and not share her personal credit history over the air.
Yeah,
how could she get in touch with you?
InvestedIndiana.org, InvestedIndiana.org. And we have a contact us page and all that, and you can shoot us a direct email, and we could connect up. And that goes for anyone with college planning questions or anything along those lines. It's all free help. That's how the best way to reach us.
Yeah. We've got a comment from a listener named Robert via Facebook, and again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Robert writes, something else to consider instead of getting such large student loans is to look at the community college scene. The first time I went to college, I went to a state school, and I split my student loans with my parents. They paid half. I took out student loans. The second time I went to school, I went to a community school and got it all paid off, and it was half the tuition of an entire year of a state school for my entire degree. How much of this, Pete, is really about just being an informed and smart consumer?
It's funny how much this parallels healthcare to a degree, about being a good healthcare consumer versus consuming a lot of healthcare, right? You can be a good education consumer as opposed to consuming a lot of education. And I think if you either A, don't know what you want to do, or B, have a very specific degree in mind, you have a better chance of ending up with less debt because you can find a school that can satisfy that. But when you're going for the experience and you're going for, you know, 4 years of an experience, there's a price tag, and it's a big one.
So we're getting really close on time here. Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
There are paths out there. We were speaking yesterday with the folks at Ben Davis, where, you know, there are ways for high school students to grab AP credits. There's also a project. I forgot the guy's name, is working on a pathing project to help people find a more inexpensive path that utilizes community colleges, that utilizes AP credits, and then transfers those credits to one of the state four-year universities. There are ways to do this, but as you said, informed consumers.
4 years cost less than five, 3 years cost less than four, et cetera, et cetera.
So since we're moving toward final thoughts here on this, because we are getting very close on time, we talked about how eighth grade is too late to start this process. At what age should you start the process?
Maternity ward. We're going to be in the maternity ward.
That's it.
Come on, Joe.
Now, the way I like to do it is when daycare costs end, pre-K, until the kid gets to kindergarten, then take the money we're paying on daycare once the kid gets in school and transition that to pre-fund college. And it's a smooth transition, and you're used to budgeting that amount. And for a lot of folks, it's the difference.
We're with you, Pete.
Yeah,
we're
that's
with
a
you.
Great idea, Pete.
Well, I would like to thank my guests, Joe Wood and Bill Wozniak, both of InvestEd. Peter Dunn, also known as Pete the Planner, one of the creators of Smart Money U. This has been a lively and informative conversation, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Certainly. And I'd also like to thank our listeners for some great questions, great comments. Clearly, we couldn't get to all of them. Clearly, this is a subject we need to talk more about. It will happen. This is not the last show we will do on student debt. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.